This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Hans Swildens is here with us today. He is the founder and managing director of Industry Ventures. So I try to bring in lots of different types of entrepreneurs. We often think of the internet, software entrepreneurs, they're the ones who get a lot of press, and I'll bring those in. Like, they have great stories and you'll definitely get exposed to them. Hans is an entrepreneur in a field that isn't known for entrepreneurship, not like software or the internet. He's from the financial services field, from the financial services industry. You know, it's been around for 100 years. You know, what could there possibly be new to do in that industry? Well, entrepreneurs always find opportunities, right? They're always finding ways to derive and create value in a marketplace. And so Hans was a pioneer in the financial services industry, despite the fact that it has been around for a long time. He identified an opportunity in the venture capital market and essentially created a secondary market for venture capital investments. So this requires just a quick explanation of what that means. Limited partners invest in venture capital funds, okay? Might be a pension, it might be UCSB's, you know, pension fund. They'll put money into a venture fund, and then whoever's running that venture fund will then make investments in specific companies. To get your money back, you have to wait until those investments in those specific companies net a return. In other words, the companies are sold, they go public, something good happens, where the stock associated with those private companies becomes liquid and is converted into cash. And that can take 8 years, it can take 10 years, it can take 7 years, it can take a long time. So an investment in a venture capital fund is relatively illiquid, meaning you can't just sell it. You can't go back to the venture fund and say, hey, can I get some of my money back? It doesn't work that way. So Hans saw that opportunity and he started making a market in those positions. So he's done hundreds of transactions in a variety of ways. So he might go to a existing venture fund started by a company, so a corporation, a corporate venture fund, and go to them and say, I'll buy your assets. I'll buy all of the investments that you've made in your corporate venture fund, and I'll take ownership of those. Well, that's good news if the company's thinking, wow, we're not going to get cash, and we don't know when these investments are going to earn net cash otherwise, so we'll take that money. And that's a market that has grown. When Hans first started this, it was a couple $100 million. It might sound like a lot of money to you guys. It's not a lot of money in the financial services industry. That's extremely small. It's now a $16, $18 billion annual market. It's grown tremendously. And it's an opportunity that just didn't exist before. Like, other people just didn't see it. That's entrepreneurship. That's identifying an opportunity and executing on it. So in addition to being an entrepreneur in the financial services industry, prior to that, Hans was an entrepreneur in the software industry. So he co-founded and ran MicroLine Software. It was acquired by Blaze Software, which eventually went public. So he had a successful company as a founder and as a president. And he's also keeps his finger on the pulse of companies by advising them and being on their boards. He's been on the boards for Discovery Mining, which was acquired by Interwoven, InCircle Network Security, Spidera Networks, which was acquired by Akamai, and Step Up Commerce, which was purchased by Intuit. So Hans earned his MBA, or his master's degree in business administration, from Columbia. But he graduated with distinction from a small school that some of you might be familiar with. It's sometimes referred to as the beach with a school. He went to UCSB. So he's a gaucho. So please join me in warmly welcoming him to our class.
So thank you. When John first invited me to this, I said, yeah, sure, I'll come down and talk. And he said, yeah, there'll be like 30 to 50 people here. And I was like, wow, that's a lot of people to listen to what I have to say. But then one of the TMP grads that's in our accounting department said, no, they get credit for going there. I was like, oh, okay, I got it. So thank you very much for coming and listening to me. John asked me to talk a little bit about my background, a little bit about what I've done since Santa Barbara, and then asked me to give you some advice, which, you know, I'm not very, very good at that, but I have some for you. My story, I'll just give you a little personal here. I had to put a mugshot of me up there. They used to be really, really poor mugshots. My wife would take them with a phone, but we actually got it professionally done a few years ago. I went to school here. I used to take exams in that row over there. I went to the UC Education Abroad program as well, which was EAP. I'm pretty sure it's still called EAP. I don't know if anybody, has anybody here gone to EAP? So, I mean, that for me was an amazing program. I also went to London School of Economics when I was here, or actually Richmond College, which is affiliated with London School of Economics. My wife went to London School of Economics and did a summer there as well. And then my fraternity was kicked off campus when I left. So I think they're back on campus, but we won't go into that. It was after I left, but I've heard they're back. Is anybody a Phi Sig in the room? Okay, so maybe they got kicked off again. But my first year I was in Anna Kappa. My wife was also in Anna Kappa. Yeah. Yeah, but my wife didn't like me in Anna Kappa. She doesn't like it. When I tell people I met my wife in Santa Barbara, she always says, no, we didn't meet there. We met in New York City. But we did. We were in the same dorm together, but she didn't like me at that point. We have three children. We live in Tiburon up in San Francisco. And I have the same hobbies that I had when I was here, which is surfing, hiking, biking, skiing, and scuba diving. And a lot of that, except for skiing, you can do right here, which I did a lot of when I was here. I was lucky to go to Columbia, and part of the reason why I was able to get in there, everyone that was there was wondering why I was there, honestly, but I was really lucky to get in there, and one reason why was, did I have to put it in here? Yeah. My first year I had a 2.9 GPA here, which is pretty bad, but my last year I had a 3.9 GPA, which was very good, and that was Dean's List the whole last couple years I was here. And when I went and I did my education abroad program, I came back and I realized, wow, I need to get my stuff together. And I applied myself. So one thing I'd recommend you to do is to do that earlier. Sorry if I'm flipping around here. In the last 12 years, all I've done is spend time building industry ventures. So it's been pretty much my sole focus. It's been an enormous amount of work. And it's gotten to the point where we have 18 people up in San Francisco, half of a floor of a building downtown on the top floor. And one of the reasons why we got to that point is that we were very innovative in our market, which John alluded to earlier. We manage over $1 billion now. Most of it, about 70% of it, is pension fund capital. So we're lucky enough to manage people's retirement money, which is a big kind of thing to hold on your shoulder. But we've been making good money for everybody. Five state plans, some insurance companies, some corporate plans and whatnot have invested with us. And then we also have our own money in our funds. The thing that made us unique, I mean, every business you start has to be unique. And if it's not unique, you probably shouldn't start it, because it's very hard to compete against others if you're not unique and you're differentiated. And so one of the things that made us unique was, initially for the first 2 years of doing this, I was trying to find a place in the industry where we could actually make money and be differentiated and have a competitive advantage. And I don't know if they teach uh, the, five forces here or the whatever, but you do as well. Everything, you teach everything. Amazing how much you teach. But the you need to have a competitive advantage. You need to be different, and you need to one thing you need to do is go into a market which is you see it, right? You see a need. You think it's going to be a big need, and that everybody will need it, and that nobody can see it. And if you can get into a market that's that early, where when you ask everybody, hey, what do you think of this, and everybody in the room says you're crazy, that's actually a good sign to spend more time figuring out whether or not that market is going to develop into a big market. But when we started doing this, 99% of the people said, there's no reason for you to do that because it doesn't, the market won't need it. What we were doing was, it was basically when the dot-com bubble collapsed in San Francisco, and it was just mayhem. And there was like 15% unemployment. Most of the businesses were going out of business. 80-90% of the venture-funded companies were getting recapitalized. It was just a very, very awful time. And so what happened was a lot of the investors that came into the market in 99 and 2000, which were the hot points of people investing in the market, needed to get, they needed to get some liquidity and they wanted to get out of the market. And there wasn't a liquidity provider for the market. And, everybody owned these certificates and companies. They owned the limited partnership interest in funds. But they, they had nowhere to sell it. And so we actually started buying them. And initially it was with some of our own money and some other individuals' money. And it ended up over a few years getting to the point where the market itself needed it to the extent where not only did some of the folks that come in the market in the dot-com bubble, like corporations that went bankrupt, like Enron, which we purchased their portfolio, but also just, angel investors, founders, hedge funds, and banks, insurance companies, all the kind of normal institutional investors or even founders in the companies were looking for ways to get some liquidity as well. And so at that point, we stepped on the gas in this business and really made an all-in bet with our own balance sheet as well as with all of our time and work, and built out a firm that focuses on the market. And up until about 2 years ago, the market wasn't a well-known market, but Facebook pretty much put it on the map where, I was trying to explain what we were doing to people for about probably 8 years, and no one would really understand it. But then once Facebook did a company liquidity program and said, hey, everyone here can sell 10% of their stock, and here's a buyer for it, it kind of lit up our market even more. And that effect of being solidifying the market in a way that made it acceptable for people to trade their stock really, really made our market grow about 2-3 times even more than it was. And so now this industry is actually a pretty big market. Last year, our firm evaluated about $9 billion of transaction volume. To put that into context, a decade ago, we're looking at maybe $50 to $100 million of deals per year. I mean, it's very different. And we built out a whole set of systems, technologies, have a relational database we built to capture and understand the market and the information better than others. So why is this interesting? It's interesting because we were a pioneering emerging market. Like any new technology or new product, it's always best to be there early. And sometimes people are there too early. And I would say we were there too early for probably about 3 or 4 years of this. But if you stick it out during those early times and the market does grow, you'll end up reaping some rewards because you'll be one of the early brands in the market that people will gravitate towards. Since we innovated in secondaries, we've also started innovating in a new area. About 3 years ago, we bought a fund-of-funds business, and we started focusing. We're one of the few fund-of-funds. We also have a separate fund, which is a fund-of-funds, that focus on small venture funds. And so most of the investors in the venture business that are institutional focus on large brand-name funds. We have a sole focus on small funds, and some of them are brand name and some of them are non-brand name, and we actually fund them with capital to start their funds, as well as we buy investors out of their funds. And one of our funds is actually Rincon, where John is, and Jim, who's probably in the audience. Prior to doing this, John told you, I started two companies with my brother. I was very fortunate. Now you can see this photo. I was very fortunate to have a brother that was a computer science engineer and was a programmer. And so I have a yin and yang with him, which works really well, which is I have a strength in sales, marketing, business development, and operations and finance, and he has a strength in computer science, programming, and technology. And we formed two companies together that were both successful. There are some photos of when I was here. I made sure that there is no beer or anything else in the photo. Actually, there is a little beer. Sorry about that. But I had a lot of fun when I was here, and it was great. I think you know this one, how to become an entrepreneur. It starts with an idea. Our idea, and we were one of three firms that had a similar idea, so we were not the only one by any means to have this idea, but we had this idea that there's no need to have an illiquid venture market. There's just no need. I mean, I was a founder, and I was ran a software company, and there was just no need to be to have a market where you create value, you own stock in something, and you're not able to actually monetize part of it. Most good ideas, contrary to popular belief, everyone else thinks you're nuts. So one of the entrepreneurs that I met told me this one time, and it's always resonated with me, and I hope it resonates with you, which is some of the best ideas you can ever have, when you ask someone about them, people think you're crazy. And those are some of the best ideas. Like if you ask Elon Musk or someone about, you know, I'm going to build rockets and launch, you know, private satellites and have a private transportation system with rockets, and I'm going to own that. People would think you're nuts. But his business now has $4 billion of backlog of revenue. The other thing you need to do, which obviously you're learning here, I did not have the benefit of that because I didn't have TMP when I was here, is how to learn a business plan, how to learn to build a business plan, a framework of the business, understanding that you need to have a business that has margins and repeatability and defensibility and things. They didn't. When I was in Santa Barbara, it was more science. It was less business. Unfortunately, most business ideas need money to launch. We launched our first company with no money, so that was really painful. Slept in the office, all of that. I'd recommend you find some money when you launch your business. But if you don't find any money, you can still do it. It takes a little more hardship. The other one is, you know, people always said this to me when I was in Santa Barbara, but it never resonated. And that was, you got to know how to sell a product, you know. And so much about any business is sales, even a financial services business like the one I own. A lot of it's sales. You know, you got to learn, why are you good? Why are you unique? How are you going to sell that? Why does someone want to work with you? Both on the buy side of our market, which is working with sellers and working with general partners and companies and the CEOs and management teams, you have to sell yourself to them as a good partner. And why you're valuable, because they don't need to work with you. There's others that they could work with. As well as investors, you need to explain why you're unique, different, why your returns are better than others, why you're sustainable. One of the hardest things about running and starting a financial services company is our market is unbelievably competitive. I mean, the two software startups I had in those markets were ridiculously competitive. The financial service market is 10 times that. And one of the reasons is that anytime any area makes money in financial services, because money's digital now, it's easy to move around. Anytime there's any place in the market that actually creates wealth, worldwide capital flows to it. And then what happens at that point is that all the returns are taken out of the market. So it's very difficult to compete in financial services. I'd take a computer science class if I was here. I didn't, and I regret it. So I just want to make sure you guys heard that. I was an intern here down at Lehman Brothers, I think it was, or Shearson Lehman it was called. And I interned for a broker down there, and I'd recommend you do something like that. It was very hard to find a job when I was here. John just gave you 10 job leads. When I was here, I used to sit in that fourth row back there. No one ever gave a job lead. So you guys are very fortunate to even have a lead. So because I was asked here to talk about being an entrepreneur in finance, I just wanted to lay out exactly what you need if you're going to be an entrepreneur in finance, what sort of attributes you need to do that, as well as what does the market need to look like if you're going to do it, in order for you to have some success rate in it. First of all, like any business, give me a second here. Like any business, if you're not passionate about it, you don't love it, you don't want to be in it every day, you don't want to be in every minute of every day and also, you know, sleep and dream about it, don't do it, okay? Because you're going to be competing with others that have that feeling and that passion, and they're going to work harder than you. So it starts with a passion. And with that passion, over time, as you spend years and years in it, you become an expert. And being an expert doesn't happen overnight. It actually takes a decade plus. And unfortunately, that's just what it takes. And I was naive when I started this and thought I could be an expert in 2 to 3 years. And literally, I didn't even start thinking I was an expert until even today. I feel like I am an expert in this market, but I kind of feel like I have more room to grow. I believe this might not be true, but only experts in niche areas in finance can actually create wealth for their investors and themselves. That's just that wealth that's sustainable for everybody, which is what you need in order to have a finance business that continues to operate. And so it's just going to be a matter of spending a lot of time and work on it. I think I touched on this earlier. Find an inefficient market in an emerging area. A lot of the best financial entrepreneurs created their markets, like the option market or certain commodity markets, futures market. There are a lot of examples of this. And financial markets are huge. So if you can create one and be a leader in it, our market's still very small compared to other markets. But like ETFs, that was a new innovation in finance. The market was enormous. It still is enormous. It's a huge emerging area. One of our venture funds that we own a part of has specialized in creating ETF funds and ETF managers, and they have absolutely crushed it. And if you look at the capital flows worldwide now into the ETF funds, it's flowing out of mutual funds, the capital, and it's flowing into ETF funds, and it's just a massive market that's still in its infancy. So you want to find something like that. You want to find it early. And you're not the only one that's going to find it. There's going to be, you know, when we found this market, there were 20 other funds and firms that tried to enter this market the same time we did. And like any financial market, there's going to be at least 20 to 50 entrants. And you need to have a competitive advantage. So when you find it, if you find it and you want to enter it, you got to make sure you enter it in a way that you have some sort of defendable competitive advantage. And that might be intellectual property, like algorithms or something. It might be the way to source and find the investments. It might be the distribution of your funds. There's a lot of different ways in finance to have a competitive advantage. And lastly, in finance, unfortunately, what I learned the hard way, it was much easier in software, by the way, you need to test out your idea before anybody will give you any money with your own money. It's so painful. This is probably the most painful one. The others are painful. This one is super painful. Nobody will give you money to do a financial services company unless they see that it works if you're investing their money. If your model is raising other money from others to invest it, unless you have a long track record doing it already at another place, which most people don't, you just have to put your wallet in it and go all in with all your own capital. And if you're wrong and you don't do it right, you're out. So you just lose all your money and you have to move on and recreate your life. So, sorry, that was a little bit hard. That's true. So why venture capital or private equity? So if you're sitting here, and if I was sitting here when you were here, and or if I was sitting here in your shoes today, why would I go into venture capital and private equity? I would go into it for these reasons. The first one is these markets are inefficient. So if you go into something that's related to a public market, which this is not, it's called private equity for a reason. Because it's a public market, everywhere, every single person around the world that's in finance can do it. So you could be in Switzerland in a little town north of Zurich called Zug, and there are hedge funds left and right in buildings looking over the Lake Zurich. All trading public stocks, okay, or bonds or whatever. It is a worldwide competitive market, public markets. Private equity, venture capital, it's not. So that's a really good thing, because it's a barrier for you. It's not like you're going to be competing with somebody in Zug, although there are a lot of people in Zug that are doing private equity now. It's an inefficient market because it's not liquid and it's not on an exchange and it's not open to the world to trade. That creates opportunity. I mean, in this market, typically you have to find your own investments, although the larger deals are often brokered, which means you got to get on the phone and in a car and a plane and go source them and find them yourself. And that's the sales skill. That's the sales rep that was at Tapjoy, that job. So you got to source your investments, which means you got to be good about networking, cold calling, presenting yourself, and be personable. And I think UCSB is very good about that. You see, this school is unique in the sense that everyone here is pretty social, and it's really fun to be here. And there's just a lot of great things for you to do when you're not sitting in your chair in this room. And that lends itself a lot to people that can sell well, so aren't afraid to get into other people. And that's a skill that you need here, and I think UCSB is unique in that. When I went to Columbia, I was sitting in a chair, just like this room was maybe half the size because the rooms are smaller. But there was a person that went to Harvard next to me on the left in a suit. I was wearing Birkenstocks and some shorts. And there was a woman to the right of me in a dress, and she had, you know, really expensive shoes on. And they both turned and introduced themselves, and I said, "Hey, it was nice to meet you. You know, it's great to be here." And they both are like, "Who are you? And why are you here?" And I'm like, "I'm from California." And they're like, "Why are you here?" I'm like, "I'm here to get educated, right?" And they had a, both of them are great. I'm friends with both of them now, but it was very interesting where our background and how we grow up here. I mean, I grew up in Minnesota, but a lot of your growing up is in college. The way you interact, how you deal with people, I think is unique here, and it lends itself to sales more. The illiquidity creates opportunities. So things that are illiquid and hard to find and source, and that also can't be easily sold, if you're in finance, that's a great thing. Real estate's semi-liquid, but some of the markets in real estate are very illiquid. People that focus on very illiquid markets in finance, and if they know what they're doing, can make a lot of money. Risk return. So I'm sure that in a class in economics here, you have efficient frontiers and all those other things. But, you know, I did when I was here, and it was very interesting. But this one in finance is paramount. I mean, you do not get a return on your capital unless you take risk. And the greater the risk, the greater the return has to be on your capital. And a lot about managing capital and being a financial manager is about understanding those two things. And I would say that's probably one of the most difficult things to manage. And it, you know, on a daily basis, weekly basis, yearly basis, is your risk return. Because you always want to make more return. And you can't make more return and take unless you understand risk and take on some risks. And one thing that I do in my job, which I think we do well, is vet risks, understand risks, try to quantify the risks, and compare them against the return. And if there is an equation in there that makes sense, which is there are risks, but you get them and you understand them and you're willing to take them on, and the return is a lot more than those risks, and you know it, and you can do that repeatably, typically you can make returns. One of the things that's unique about venture capital specifically is there's massive return potential, specifically in the early stage. What John's doing and others are is formation in the formation sector, forming new companies. I don't need to explain that one to you. There's just massive return potential. If you can get a lot of the business right and you can be differentiated and sustainable and you can compete well in your market and grow, there's just massive returns. This one I didn't really start getting because I moved out to Silicon Valley initially to start a company with my brother. And he wrote part of Netscape Navigator. And when I was here, supposedly the internet was invented and we were one of the three universities that actually used it. There were like 8 computers or something. There weren't that many computers actually that were online. But the one thing that resonates after being in this market for almost 20 years is that we operate the tech industry and venture capital specifically in one of the few areas of growth in this whole economy. So one thing I didn't appreciate when I was here was we're in California, you're in Santa Barbara, Silicon Valley's, a short drive from here. There's a lot of innovation here in Santa Barbara now. There was not when I was here. As well as down in Los Angeles, there's a ton of innovation now. And you're right in the epicenter of innovation in the world. And so I didn't get that when I was here. I didn't understand that. And I think you guys are all very fortunate to be in this state, as well as have an opportunity to go into growth areas. Because in other states and other universities in the United States and abroad, they don't have the proximity nor the connections to enter into markets that are hyper growth, that are innovative, and you do. One of my classmates went to work at sales in Oracle, and this was in 1992 when I graduated. I'm 42 now, and he's still there. I mean, I don't know why he's there anymore, but. He's still there, and that business has absolutely crushed it. Another one went to Amgen. I mean, crushed it. When I went to Columbia, it's a great university, but 90% of the people went in finance, or they went in, which now I'm in, but I went and did software first, or consulting. And so they weren't going into hyper-growth areas. We have the opportunity here, you do, to go into extreme high growth areas, and that's very, very unique. So, we'll get into Q&A in a second. I wanted to spend some more time on Q&A. This is only 6 slides, I think. I'm taking too long here. But the advice from the old gaucho. So 20 years ago, I was sitting in your chair. I took an exam over there, and it was horrible. I still remember it. First thing, find something you're passionate about. I get really passionate about stuff. It's just how I am. And so for me, starting companies and being involved in innovation and new formations and new markets is extremely exciting. Like, it's something that just gets me excited. And if it doesn't get you excited, then don't do it, okay? But if you can find something you're passionate about and spend a lot of time on it and become an expert at it, you'll do great. And that even means like playing the guitar or doing something like that. Don't be afraid to take the first step. This one, everyone always has a problem with this. You meet people, they talk about a great idea or something they really wish they'd want to do, and then you say, well, why don't you go do it? And they give you 10,000 reasons why. The one piece of advice I can give you is, just go do it, okay? And don't ask other people if they think it's stupid, because most people will tell you it is. And the more people that tell you it's stupid, you should the more you should probably go do it, which is counterintuitive. Be different. That's another one. If you're not different and you're just like everybody else, no one's going to care. I mean, honestly. So you need to find something about yourself that's different and just be different. And that's what people will remember. We had a guy come into our office for an interview, and he came from Berkeley, and he'd never had a job before. And he came in, and I wouldn't recommend you doing this, okay? This worked for him, for us, for a strange reason. But he came in, and he had his shirt buttoned down here, and he had a pair of, like, L.A., he was from L.A., sunglasses hanging down. And he sat down, and he's like, yeah, I'm just looking for a job. You know? And everyone in the office was looking at him going, what? This guy is nuts. We're not giving this guy a job. And then everybody was like, all right, we'll give him a shot. And we talked to him. And one thing he actually is at Harvard Business School right now. I'm not kidding. He's awesome. Okay. But he was very different, and everybody remembered him when we left and we still joke about him, honestly. And it's been 8 years or something ridiculous. So be different. People remember that, and if you're not remembered, then you were never there. Focus on creating value for others. This one, I kind of do this to a fault, but this is just who I am. I really try to create value for other people, and my objective there is that if I'm creating value for them, at some point, value is going to come back. And so the idea of, you know, giving as much as you can to other people, and you know, you can't do this to a fault, right? Sometimes I do. But, you know, give as much as you can to other people and help them, and what goes around comes around. And I don't think a lot of people understand that. And that is it. So, I hope I...
So we do have time for questions, and because this is being filmed and it'll be shown on UCTV, I ask you to take the mic and ask your question, even though it's awkward. You have to wait a second. So who has the first question? Right up here in the front.
Hi, how's it going? My first question would be, how do you feel? Do you feel that the MBA is a worthwhile degree, or do you believe that you can be a prosperous entrepreneur without it?
Well, if you're going into technology and you're going into the normal technology areas, I personally think you don't need an MBA. And I think you're better off taking computer science classes and getting a degree in computer science or something like that. If you're going to go into technology, or if you're going to go into biotechnology, go get, you know, a biochem degree or something. You're better off specializing in technology in a specific technical area than you are going to get a generalist business degree. It's just a fact. But if you want to go into finance, I think it's almost an imperative that you need to have some sort of business degree. I don't meet too many of my colleagues. I know every founder of every firm like mine. There's about 50 of them. That have any size. And I think every single one, with the exception of maybe one or two, has an MBA or a JD. And I think one reason why that's the case is that if you're going to get to a point in finance where you're actually talking to institutional investors and you're talking to people that are very sophisticated, you need to have a background of general business concepts that are generalist in different areas, and you get that through an MBA. And I think the other thing you need to have is you really need to have an understanding of what financials are in a company and what drives them and how you can manipulate them, because there's a lot of fraud in finance. And if you can't build it from the ground up, if you can't take a company and take every dollar that flows into the company and it's with its cash flow, and then every dollar that flows out of the company and understand how all the financial statements work, then you probably don't know what you're doing. And I think you need to go get an MBA to do that.
Because the reason I ask is because I'm a science guy, mm-hmm. and I don't really have the business background. So I was thinking about going through that avenue, but I also hear you can self-educate in the same in the same way.
Yeah, my brother did not get an MBA, and he's been retired for 7 years.
Okay. No.
Fair enough. And he's written probably 15, 20 patents and invented some really cool stuff. And he had no need for an MBA.
And any of you guys that have taken my class know how I feel about the MBA, right? Use those 2 years.
I don't know how you feel.
Creating a company.
You think it's useless?
Yes. Well, for an entrepreneur.
It's a badge of credibility,
I think. I think if you're in financial services, it's different.
Yeah.
What about a law degree?
That's worse.
Sorry. I thought you were I
love attorneys. I work with them every day. I can't say anything bad about them. Without attorneys, I can't do my job. But there are not many attorneys that are running financial service firms. So if you want to run a financial service firm, I would get a JD MBA if you're going to get a JD.
Next question. And so as Hans was saying about what all of his cohorts, most of his cohorts went to after MBA school, they go to consulting, they go to banking. So most people that get an MBA don't go into entrepreneurship. One reason is you can make so much money after you go to these schools that it's even harder to make that leap that Hans was talking about.
Yeah, just a fact there too. Like when I got my MBA, I was given an offer to join a consulting company that paid for my entire second year of school. Okay, that gave me a 5-figure sign-up bonus, that gave me a 6-figure salary with an opportunity to get a 5-figure bonus, and I turned it down to come back to California and make very little money, which most people would think is insane. But if you go into a career, you should do it for a long time. And personally, I didn't want to be a consultant for 10 years of my life. And I wanted to live back in California. So I turned that down.
I know that right now you're doing a financial company, but this question might be a little bit more geared towards like tech companies and stuff like that. You had like 18 people working for you right now in San Francisco or what have you. Mm-hmm. When you're first starting up a startup, does it hurt to have a lot more people working for you, or would you rather have it more close-knit at the beginning?
I like close-knit. I think all great ideas and great technologies created with a very small amount of people.
Does it hurt, though, to have extra hands around willing to help for free?
It doesn't hurt, but it distracts you from doing what you should be doing, which is creating something great. So I would opt for a small team and not bring in people around you. If you look at what happens in Silicon Valley, all the best technologies you guys use every day that are technical, or on the internet, or in your phone or on your PC or whatever, all that's created by a small team. In fact, most of it's only created by a handful of engineers. So core technology, which drives all of innovation, is typically invented by a small amount of people and small teams. And one of the problems that the large companies have is they have the opposite mentality, which is, hey, let's throw 100 people on the problem. But what you don't realize is you can do that, but then those 100 people can't agree and they can't work together and they can't create something quickly, because there's too much bureaucracy and everybody has their own opinion and they all want to do the same way. It's better off to have a small team. And I would say a small team with a leader, one person. So I also believe that it's really about a small team with a leader. And if you really need to pick your leader, you can't have 2 or 3 leaders. You need to have one person that leads. It's like a sharp spear. If you're gonna do it and drive it in, you need something really super sharp with a lead with a point. And you'll be able to do it faster and get deeper than anybody else. I got kind of a unique background because you can throw You can throw startup questions at me too, because I have that in my background as well. Okay. If you want to throw some software startup stuff at me, you can do that too.
I'm more interested in the 99-2000. You said when you entered the industry, you didn't have too much money, and you put a lot of money, your own money into it.
Yep.
But you kept saying you had a competitive edge, or you told us we need a competitive edge. What was your competitive edge that made you keep sustaining your industry or company?
To start, it was just I worked harder than anybody else. I mean, I think you probably heard that from other people that have stood up here. I just worked harder, and I was smarter about it, and I made sure that I made it repeatable. And my competitors either didn't work hard enough, it wasn't repeatable, or they didn't have the connections that I did, right? So when you start, you have nothing. Okay, so you don't have a competitive advantage day one, right? I think if you start and you realize that you don't have a competitive advantage day one, but you need one to survive, you will learn to get one and put one in. And so what I've done over the years is just continuously get deeper and deeper and deeper with more information and knowledge. And then there's some things that we do internally that we don't talk about, but it allows us to have a competitive advantage, both deal sourcing, finding the opportunities, as well as pricing them, understanding the pricing of we lose money too, like everybody in financial services. But as long as we make money more times than we lose money, and that's hopefully a 90-10, then you're doing just fine. And we have some things around how we model price and diligence the investments that makes us feel more comfortable understanding those risks. And sometimes we'll get those risks wrong. But if you can have a predictable way to mitigate risk with a certain type of return, which is high, you're able to produce compounded returns over time. And so we've done some things internally here for the last, it's been 12 years. So that we can compete. And I think if you don't do that in your business, you just will be out-hustled by everyone else. So I mean, if you think of financial services, a lot of it's a commodity, right? I mean, you go and you have a bank account. That's a commodity, right? I mean, you can all start a bank if you want. You know, mortgages, that's a commodity, right? I mean, what's the difference between a mortgage from one bank from a mortgage from another bank? So a lot of what in this industry, in financial services in general, some of it's about distribution, right? Some of it's about pricing, understanding the risks, right? Because if you can loan out mortgages and understand why you have a lower loss rate than the industry and your competitors, you'll have a higher return than all your competitors, right? If you can also have a higher volume of loan distribution than your competitors, right, then you'll actually have more loans out there. You'll see more loan deals you can underwrite. Then you can pick and choose and have a better quality of loan you might be able to underwrite. And there's some other things around this industry that you can do to create kind of competitive, sustainable advantages of capital. And this is I lose sleep at night for these issues because we need to continually innovate. I mean, one of the things with financial services, which is similar to technology companies, is you have to be innovating every day. I mean, it's so painful because everyone else is innovating every day. And if you're not innovating faster than they're innovating, then you're getting out-innovated. And, you know, that drives growth, right? It'll drive market growth. It'll drive but if you're not the ones on the leading edge innovating and you get out-innovated, you're obsolete and you're done. And it was much easier to start a software company and an internet infrastructure business than it was to start this. This was like 10 times harder. So if I would have known what I know now, I would have not done it. That's for sure. And my wife would tell you that too, by the way.
During your the process when you're negotiating with venture capital firms and private equity, what is your relationship like with the startup that you're buying the stake in? What is your relationship like with them during that process?
So for me, as a person who's founded a company and two companies actually, I've been on that side of the table. So our whole firm is built to be a partner with them. the thing that's important for us and one differentiator of our business versus our competitors is that we're entrepreneur friendly. We're also venture firm friendly. And so we have competitors that are more like an activist, right? They're not friendly. They're more like a buyer, and then they get take an activist approach to try to effect change or get on the board or do something to act kind of hostile. We're the exact opposite. We're here as a solution provider trying to help people. So it's about, hey, let's talk about one of the best stories I have that I tell some investors sometimes is I won't tell you his name, but he would tell you who he is. I got a call one time from a founder, and he's like, listen, I need to sell some stock because I don't have any money, and on paper I'm worth $80 million, right? Because I own 30% of this business. You know, it raised a round of capital at $250 million or whatever it would be, and I'm worth $80 million. And he said, I just need to sell some stock. And I'm like, well, why do you need to sell now? You know, what's the driving reason? He's like, because my wife wants to buy a house. And I'm like, well, can't you just live in what you got? And he's like, no. I'm like, well, why? And he's like, because she's pregnant. We're living in a one-bedroom apartment. We're in Palo Alto. She wants to buy a house. I'm like, everyone else has houses? I'm like, I would recommend you don't sell your stock. Okay? And so then he's like, all right, I'll go back and talk to her about it. And then he calls me back and goes, no, she really, really wants me to sell some stock. And I'm like, no, I think your company is, going to keep growing. You shouldn't sell. But if you really want to sell, I'll buy it from you, right? And he goes, all right, I'll go talk to her again. He talks to her again. Calls me back and says, I want to sell. I don't want to sell $5 million because that's the house she wants to buy. She wants to buy a house that's like, it was $3 million, and he needed to pay taxes when he sold. So netted out, he needed $5 million net of tax. Because in Silicon Valley, houses cost $2 to $3 million. And I said, fine, all right, here's the price we pay. And we bought the stock, and I get a call from his wife. It was like probably 6 months later. And she's like, I am so happy, where I'm in my house, in my kitchen right now, and it's all because of you. And our it was such a stressful time for us. And, without you, we would be here. And then he actually is in the venture business now, okay? Because that business went public, actually, and made an enormous amount of money. And now he's a venture capitalist. And I saw him at a conference the other day, and he's like, and I said, are you still living in the house? Because you've made so much money. You probably don't need to live in that house anymore. And he's like, oh, I love my house. My life, he's like thankful for me helping him buy his house. So we take that approach. We don't take the approach of, hey, how can we try to take advantage of this person? And I think that is a differentiator for our business. And it relates to the reputation you build. So even though I'm 42, our firm is very young. And for us, we're going to be in this for a long time, hopefully. And if that's repeated hundreds and hundreds of times in a very small business, you get a reputation, and a reputation is an advantage. Is there anyone else?
Do you see any trends in the energy field?
Yes. Right now, there are some really horrible investment trends and some really amazing investment trends in energy. Right now is a time in clean technology, okay, which is quite interesting from our secondary fund's perspective. So we actually just did our first clean tech deal 2 quarters ago. So what happens in the venture business is everybody comes in and funds this new innovative sector and then if one investor makes a 10 times or 100 times return on their money, 100 other investors will show up and see if they can try to, make money in that type of deal. And what that happened in clean tech in 08, 09, 010, really? I mean, maybe it started back in 06, 07, but kind of gained a lot of steam in like 08, 09, 010. And even the White House got involved, and our tax dollars went to work in some of these deals. And right now, I would say 80% of the clean tech venture deals that were funded in the last 6 years are having problems getting new financing, getting their business models to work. A lot of them were very capital efficient and required huge capital expenditures. And without more capital in these things, they can't sustain themselves and they go bankrupt. And there's this massive, massive backlog of clean tech investments in the venture business. It's huge. The amount of money in there is staggering. And they're all failing. I mean, 80% of them. That said, there's 20% of them, which are creating massive new opportunities that might be 100 plus time return deals. And so you have a situation where, in general, the venture market's bearish today on clean tech because they went under all these deals, right, in the last 5 years. They put in billions and billions and billions in all these deals, and they're starting to fail, and they can't take them public, and nobody wants them, and they can't raise capital for them, and they're on the boards, and everyone's yelling at each other, right? Because they can't raise capital, and things are going to blow up, and how are they going to fund it, and they're, And that's what's going on. But there is about 20% of these deals which really are just game-changing technologies and companies. And the ones that I like are the capital-efficient ones, so which aren't many of them, right? So the ones that are really capital efficient, like there's some material science companies, which are really interesting. And actually, Santa Barbara has a great material sciences department. And in fact, I think the LED Institute here is the number one in the world or two. Yeah. And we owned a part of a company, which was a material science company called Cambridge Display, which is an organic light emitting diode technology company out of Cambridge University in England. And it was bought by Sumitomo to do different, display technologies. But in terms of other material science inventions lately, there's a lot of things around LED lighting and the powders and everything that goes into actually making the lights consume less energy and have a brighter light come out of it that doesn't consume as much power. There's a lot of those types of inventions out there that are extremely exciting, and they're game changing, right? For energy, to save energy, produce it, and to improve how you consume it.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.